Good evening. I'd like to call to order the Thursday, March 15th meeting of the Zone 3 Advisory Committee. Call to order, and is there a roll call, please?
Sure. Member Molnar.
Present.
Member Gehring.
I'm here.
Member Vardis.
Here.
Member Lucy.
Present.
Member Wallace.
Here.
Member Akita.
Here.
And Chairman Costello.
Here. Thank you. We have a quorum. I'd like to invite public comment at this point. It's an opportunity for any members of the public to address, the committee on items that are not on tonight's agenda. Is anyone interested in addressing the committee tonight? Seeing no one, we'll close the public comment, please.
Well, that'll be done by Mr. Coleman.
Thank you. Mr. Coleman, if you would.
Good evening, everyone. How are we doing? Can you hear me?
Yep, good.
Okay, we'll start with Lopez Lake information. Elevation today was 515.52. Storage, 43,142. Capacity of 87.7%. Rainfall to date, 9.18 inches. And downstream releases, 3.3 MGD, million gallons a day. As far as the treatment plant, all the treatment processes are running very efficiently. Production, water treatment plant production is 4.0 MGD. State water production is 1.4 MGD. All five membrane filter racks running smoothly, and run turbidities are less than 0.02, which is very good.
Very good. Questions? See if anyone has any questions. Seeing none. Thank you for your report, sir.
Thank you.
Item 5, the budget.
If we can, that's been moved down to item 9, so if we go to informational items, please.
Very good. Thank you. We shall do that. Brings us to item 6, informational items. Start with the Habitat Conservation Plan status report.
John, if you can bring up... Chairman Costello, members of the committee, my name is Mark Hutchinson. I'm the Department of Public Works Environmental Programs Manager. It's been a long day already. I have a briefer PowerPoint than average, updating you on the status of the Habitat Conservation Plan. As you recall, we do have a presentation schedule, and we're down here at March 15th. And our focus this evening is on the downstream release program. The information I have is derived from that attachment to your staff report, which is simply titled The Hydrologic Analysis for the Rio Grande Creek Habitat Conservation Plan Update 2011. It is essentially the downstream release program, the science behind it, and the background information used to develop it. Should also let you know that the Technical Advisory Committee has formed a subcommittee to look at issues with the HCP, and that subcommittee met on March 1st, looked specifically at this downstream release program. So much of what I have for you comes from the deliberations of the subcommittee. So the downstream release program is actually the plan for operating the dam and controls releases from the dam into Arroyo Grande Creek. It's a key component of the HCP. Because it will describe and control the operational activities of the dam. That is, those parts of the project involving water that's not diverted into the treatment plant. It's essentially the plan for turning the water on, off, up, and down throughout the years and seasons. It's fundamental to the HCP because it is the document that will provide assurance of continued municipal water supply. It will demonstrate compliance with the Endangered Species Act requirements, and it provides a model to monitor and verify the results, that is, impact on the reservoir and the species. That model is key to the downstream release program, and the majority of that 91-page attachment describes how that model was developed and all the information that went into it. It has two fundamental elements. It was designed to maintain a safe and reliable water supply and also to simulate natural conditions in the stream by establishing minimum in-stream flow, and also introducing variations into the flow to more closely match habitat needs. When you look at the document, you'll see the phrase IHA. That's been a major focus of effort over the last 4 years. It stands for Indicators of Hydrologic Alteration, and it is a system by which biologists and water managers assess a stream, both its current condition and its historic condition, to try to identify the degree to which it's been altered by human activities. In short, they develop 32 separate parameters to measure these hydrologic systems. They look at the magnitude of the water, timing of occurrence, frequency of occurrence, duration of time over which a specific water condition exists, and the rate of change in water conditions from one moment to the next. They compare that within years and also from year to year. It ultimately generates 64 different data points by which they assess a water nine. They met with the consultant and looked at several different alternatives for developing the model and established some basic parameters, one of which was the IHA, which was requested by National Marine Fisheries Service. Also requested by National Marine Fisheries Service as we develop release programs for dry years, normal years, and wet years. When you read the program, you'll notice that the normal and wet years ended up being combined, which is essentially where we started in 2004, and that the TAC also required that there be ways to adjust the base flows and the attraction flows in response to what's happening in the reservoir. So again, from the TAC, some of the foundations of the model, we used numbers, detailed numbers. It's a massive spreadsheet that's kept by the operators of the dam that records reservoir levels, municipal deliveries, stream inflow, downstream releases, evaporation, all of those parameters from 1969 to 2004. One of the last things the consultant did was added the most recent information, 2004 to 2010, to verify that the model is still accurate, which it is. Maximum lake storage, as we know, is 49,400 acre-feet. The project has a safe yield of 8,730 acre-feet a year with municipal diversions, that is the contractual amount, 4,530. And historically, up until 1980s, when the dam retrofit project came into being, the downstream release was about 2,330 acre-feet. So the TAC set these limits. There could be no impact to the municipal deliveries from the downstream release program. The reservoir would never fall below 12,730 acre-feet. That is 1 year of safe yield above minimum pool of 4,000 acre-feet. 4,000 acre-feet is the level at which we simply can't get water out of the reservoir. The maximum passage release, and we'll see what that looks like in a graph, would be 40% of the Lopez Creek flow, which matches quite closely to what's happening downstream from the dam. There's quite a bit of work done to match those hydrologic curves. And that the reservoir would have at least 2 years of storage after a full 7-year drought, as evidenced in the historic hydrology from 69 to 2004. So we came up with numbers like this. These are the base flow numbers that are in the proposal as it currently stands. You see the dry year numbers on the left side and the wet year numbers on the right side. We'll talk a little bit about how those dry years and wet years are determined. You can see that in a dry year, the total downstream release is 3,898 acre-feet, which is a little bit below the 4,200 that would make the safe yield when added to municipal. But in the wet years, the number goes up, and it's able to essentially deliver greater than safe yield by diverting water that would otherwise spill over the spillway into the release program over time. And for people who may be watching, I was asked to include this slide. All of these numbers are in cubic feet per second and acre feet and things like that to help us orient. We came up with this for 1 cubic foot and 1 cubic feet per second, all the way down through those numbers as to how much water would actually be released. You can see that at 1 cubic feet per second, it's 650,000 gallons a day, with minimum flows of 3 cubic feet per second. 2.5 million gallons a day would be released during a drier flow. So we can kind of take those numbers, and put them back into that table and see where we are. And now it gets fun. At the TAC subcommittee, we worked through a series of graphs. So you can see cubic feet per second on the left, the months across the bottom. The red line represents how much water would be released on a month-by-month basis during what's termed a dry year. And the yellow line is the release program base flows that we switch to when it's a wet year. The determination between dry and wet begins with a zero on October 1st and measure the total inflow to the reservoir. When that reservoir inflow, beginning at zero on October 1st, reaches 6,790 acre feet, it becomes a wet year, and we switch to the yellow line. If we never get to 6,790, it becomes a dry year release. And what's interesting, that would occur wet year about two-thirds of the years historically and dry year about one-third of the years historically. The other interesting note is that 6,790 is higher than the municipal deliveries on an annual basis. Then it gets fun. There's adjustments for high flow conditions. There is a stream gauge on Lopez Creek above the reservoir. It's operated by the USGS and has about 33 cubic feet per second of a release, and then as Lopez Creek subsides, the release goes back down again. Then we get into an adjustment for drought conditions. And this was interesting because it does not depend on rainfall amounts from the watershed. It is based on inflow into the reservoir. So we disconnected it from rain gauges and those. It's really based on what is flowing into the reservoir. We keep records of those on a daily basis, actually. But when the running average inflow is less than 26,190 acre feet per year, then the maximum release from the dam is dropped to 3 cubic feet per second year-round until we exceed 26,190. By the way, 26,190 is 3 years of safe yield. And that has historically, when we back it into the graphs and the numbers for what's been happening at the reservoir since 1969, that is the indicator that we're into a multi-year drought. So there's no high-flow, low-flow release. It simply is represented by the flat red line at 3 cubic feet per second year-round.
Can I ask a question now?
Sure.
Just because it'll go out of my thought. When the creek is running high and you say we release more water, what is the purpose of releasing more water at that time? Is that to simulate natural conditions?
Absolutely. That's part of the program through that IHA analysis to try to make the creek below the dam behave it as it would if there were no dam.
Okay.
And that would serve in most years as an attraction flow. We'd be into a wet year. There should be water over the sandbar. And that would put enough water out in the ocean so that steelhead could find the entrance to the creek, and also enough water for passage over any barriers that are existing.
Then conversely, then, the minimum, though, we would ever would be the 3?
Well, interestingly, there's a second drought trigger.
Because if it's a dry year, naturally a dry year, if the dam wasn't there, it would be bone dry down there, but we're still going to release water.
Actually, it's represented by 3. It's 3 cubic feet per second or the average inflow, the total inflow to the dam over the previous 2 weeks, whichever is less. So I represented it with the flat line at 3, but if the inflow of the creek was less than 3 cubic feet per second, we would be releasing that amount. So in those years where Rio Grande Creek is essentially not flowing, Wittenberg Arm typically goes dry every summer, Lopez Creek sometimes can get way down there, you would see the flow through the dam just matching the inflow. However, if the reservoir storage approaches 12,730 acre feet, that means we have 1 year of water storage left, then we go to the National Marine Fisheries Service under emergency conditions and establish a different release number. We have not yet at this point had the conversation with National Marine Fisheries Service to find out how that process would work. and we would intend to do that, and so we can get a very good picture of whether they're just going to say no all the time or whether it's something that can be built into the HCP and depended on. But that's what the release program is at now. So certainly during those drought triggers, it could go lower.
Thank you.
So, where am I at? That's the longer-term drought. What does it do to the reservoir? I just put one of these graphs in. In the HCP, there is a tremendous number of them. This is actually the blue line is what the reservoir has done in volume storage between 1969 and 2004. If this program had been in place since 2004, this release program, the green line would represent what the reservoir would have done, and this is what the model does for us. So we can see that during that multi-year drought, we would have gotten close to that 12,700 number, which would have triggered an adjustment in the releases well below what the inflow might have been. But this is the kind of work that's demonstrated in the downstream release program to determine the effects on the reservoir. At the subcommittee, we had some conversation about longer-term climate change and how that might work. It's interesting to note, as I said earlier, that the dry year, wet year is based on inflow to the reservoir, not on rainfall. So we think, at this point, that it is pretty self-adjusting for longer-term drier periods. If we get into those drier periods and don't trigger the wet year inflow, then the release numbers are following the lower graphs. So the conclusion of the draft is that the program can be implemented in a way that works for habitat over a wide range of environmental conditions, which is what the agencies require, but also maintains a reliable water supply that meets the district's contractual requirements. However, whether or not we're going to run the farmers out of water, what the implications of that mean. So at this point, quite a bit of ongoing study.
Okay, because that was going to be a question that I had about clarifying that. For those farmers that actually have contractual obligations with Lopez and those that don't, needs to be clarified in terms of their relationship.
As far as we know, there's no farmers who have a water contract with Lopez, but there may be some that have water rights, historic water rights, which is one question. The larger question on agriculture simply is, what is the impact of this program on farming in the Arroyo Grande Valley? And that's aside and perhaps beyond the question of water rights. And then how would the Board of Supervisors and the various city councils consider a program and what its impact might be on the farming community, which is a major part of our community and part of our economy, certainly in the Arroyo Grande Valley. The TAC subcommittee is very much aware of that, so we'll be looking closely at this situation and ultimately working with the consultants on model runs to see what the actual effect is going to be on agriculture. So what I have as a last slide, right now we've got these people covered and the fish covered. We're working on making sure that we have that covered.
Now, so what you've presented tonight, is this a certain portion of the HCP that's about ready to be presented with the whole thing? I mean, do we have to work on this? It's a hydrology, is that correct?
Well, this is the downstream release program is really the guts of what the HCP proposes to do. Now I realize that you weren't here last November when we talked about moving the HCP ahead in parallel with dealing with this issue.
I was in the audience.
The water availability analysis. So we're still in the mode where we're expecting H.T. Harvey to move ahead, working on the parts of the HCP that aren't directly dependent on finalizing the downstream release program, so we can do the water availability analysis, perhaps do some more model runs, work with the consultant, also with the community and the farmers through that water availability analysis, and then bring it back together and be confident that we have a downstream release program that doesn't have significant negative effects on farming. There may be some cooperative efforts that need to happen to make it all work. We'll certainly be exploring those.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question for you, Mark. You talked about the, I think the month of October is the first month we look at, and we go from that on.
Right.
So then do we go from October 1 to September 30th or whatever, and that's a year, and then effective October 1st, that's the program that we're setting for the release?
Well, the way it would work, and there's a couple, actually, examples buried in that document. We start measuring inflow on October 1st. At that point, it's a dry year, so we're releasing at the dry year levels that we saw, and there's a peak for the winter. We might reach 6790 in January, and then we ramp up. There's actually a ramping schedule to the yellow line. If we don't reach 6790 until March, the same thing occurs. We actually ramp up. I showed a series of graphs of the TAC where historically that would have occurred in different years, and it takes simply the large red line and moves it later in the year. Ultimately, they always drop back down to the wet year or dry year.
It's going to be a variable based on the actual inflow. We're not going to go and say, what's the past year been? It's what's the rate we're doing.
Yeah. Past years come into effect when we look at total average inflow over those last three. So if we if we're not at that 26,000 acre foot number, that overrides, takes us to the 3 CFS or inflows, whichever is lower. And while we're recording the inflow, we may reach 6790, but if it doesn't bring our 3-year average up above 26,000, we're still in a drought trigger number one.
See if anybody else has questions.
Yeah. I got a question.
Please, Jim.
Mark, looking at your slide with the lake reservoir levels on it.
Mm-hmm. Just came back up.
Looking at my copy, at least, it says we got a comparison between historical operations and HCP baseline. Question I have is, does the baseline, the HCP baseline level, does that include historical levels of surplus?
You know, based on the 2009 document with the TAC, I don't believe it does. Although, the model certainly includes the full production of the system. If that's...
When the graph says HCP baseline condition, what does it mean by baseline?
I think it's just the number that's generated from the models. I don't think...
Is there another HCP condition that... No.
Okay. No. There's at least not in the document I can find.
All right. Well, I'm concerned about the surplus issue in that water has been used in the past. And it certainly was produced between 1970 and 1985 and has been produced in the last few years. Where is that water going to come from? Presumably from the groundwater basin if it has the safe yield to produce it.
It's an interesting question given the, I'll just say, part of the groundwater basin's connection to the dam and the creek flows.
Yeah.
And whether there's any kind of a obvious offset there.
All right. Okay, thank you.
Great question. Anyone else have questions? Please, John.
Mark, just a reference back to the volume of the reservoir. Does the model take into consideration siltation either now or into the future?
My understanding is the model is based on the latest bathymetric survey, mm-hmm. but I didn't see anything in the model for adjusting those numbers for future siltation.
I know the rate has been slower than what we thought it was going to be, but perhaps the model might want to consider that at some point in the future if this is a long-term process or a long-term model for us.
I wonder if we need to look at, I guess essentially the sedimentation would just take up part of the below the minimum pool.
Well, it also changes the dynamics of the model, too, in terms of the total storage and production from the dam. So
we can look at that.
Yeah. I'm concerned about the impact on ag in the summertime. It looks like from your graph that there was about a six-month period of time from July through November or so that the releases might not be sufficient enough to replenish the wells downstream. Do you think that, I guess a couple of questions, do you think that the water availability analysis will solve that question for us? And if not, how do we resolve that going forward? And maybe this is a question Barton is going to ask, but seems like it's a very important question to the ag users downstream.
Definitely. And at the TAC subcommittee, we talked about a couple of different approaches. We think it's important to get the water availability analysis so we have that information before we spend a whole ton of time going down different approaches to it. But the kinds of questions that we need to ask are, for farmers downstream, for those, say, whose wells are more aquifer-dependent, if I could use that, versus creek flow-dependent, then does the higher wintertime flows offset the lower summer? We have that question, and we're cogitating on how to answer that. And then, mostly for the farmers farther up in the valley, is there less of an effect from higher winter, discharges into the streamside aquifer? And is it possible, perhaps, to shift some of the winter flows into some timed releases in the summer? We have a ramping rate of something like 1 foot of elevation per hour. How does it affect fish and the farmers if we plan ahead for irrigation demands and then ramp up some sharper peaks from the 3 to maybe 6 or 7 and then back down again? Those are the kinds of questions that are being asked that we'll discuss at the subcommittee and then try to determine how to go about testing those.
Yeah, I know this is going to be brought back through the TAC, but it seems like it's a really important question in terms of refining the model as you go forward. And then finally, how much has NIMS bought into the refinements that we've been making on the model and the downstream release program? Or, asking another way, are we too far ahead of NIMS, or are they seemingly buying into what we're doing here?
I think, based on the conversations I've had with staff who've been in the regular meetings with them up until this point, NIMS is very satisfied with the program as it exists. We did check into the review process to see how far up in the agency that information goes, and we're comfortable that we're in a good position, that the staff who've looked at it in detail actually are very close in relationship to the folks who are going to have to look at it and approve it. That's good and bad. I think at this point, as a staff member, you technically can't commit or hint right on behalf of the agency. We can read body language, but
we're familiar with that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'll make a note of that, and we'll see at what point in the process, and then try to figure out at what point on the calendar it would be appropriate.
Okay, thanks.
Bart, do you have questions?
Sure. First of all, I'm happy to hear that you're concerned about the effects on ag, as I know our whole community, ag communities, very interested to see how these different release program will have an effect on the groundwater recharge, which I'm sure the city of Arroyo Grande and other cities that pump well water are going to want to know the same effect. But I had a question about that. There was I think it's a slide right here, actually. Oh, no, it's not that one. You had one that showed the three different examples of releases. One was a normal year, maybe a wet year, dry year, and the past.
The one with the interim downstream release rate on it.
It's about the third from the last slide, I think.
That one?
Yeah. No.
It's one that shows the impact.
Very much toward the end.
Oh, okay.
Slide 23. There was that one there.
There we go. I think that one's it there. In these three scenarios, is there a big difference in the amount of water that's released total?
Not a big difference, but This green one is, well, actually the red one, the dry year, would be the least amount. That's about 3,800 acre feet downstream.
Okay.
The green is close to that, a little bit more, and then the red is in the 5,000, or the yellow is in the 5,000, excuse me.
Yeah. I would like to say that I do think that you mentioned that there's some coordination would have to be worked out. I think that could be worked out, you know, with the, I don't think that, and if you're looking at that yellow line as the normal year, I don't know, maybe that's going to get turned into eventually that's the old ag line, you know, even though it wasn't always for ag. I don't think there's any farmer that needs a downstream release that high in January. We don't, just don't plant that much, you know. So I'm sure there's some coordination that can get worked out.
Yeah, the question, and of course everybody really, the question is whether it's possible to, what's the word, shave a little water off the yellow line and move it to the summer, and the same with the red, take a little off the top, move it to the summer, or maybe a little off the ends of the graph, move that water for agriculture.
Mr. Chair, and is that what the water availability analysis will help you to determine whether periods, let's say, under let's say dry years, you know, starting in May through November, December, that water availability analysis will help you determine whether additional water is required or flow for the farmers, and then that if that information can be presented back to the resource agencies, to NIMS, so if necessary to make adjustments for the winter flows?
Well, I think, you know, one important part of the water availability analysis is the water rights question.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to actually know what that number is before we do a lot of planning one way or another. Certainly if the water rights number is, you know, below those lines, well, that's interesting, but then we simply have the impact issue that we need to deal with, the economic, the community, the farming. On the other hand, if that number's significantly higher, well, then that's a different approach because needs to be dealt with in that. So assuming that the water availability analysis, that part of it is coming relatively soon in terms of HCP timelines, we felt it was prudent to at least have that before we start making some major work efforts for consultants and agency staff folks in all the cities towards running models and discussing scenarios.
And I apologize ahead of time if this has been answered in the past, but what happened to the water getting to 22nd Street Bridge? I heard that numerous times. I'm not sure where it came from. Mm-hmm.
My understanding, it was an unofficial determination of how to operate the dam.
Okay.
So our understanding is that during some time period, it was decided that that's the way it would be operated. We don't see that in any agreements or anything.
Able, and we began the studies to determine what needed to be done, and then we got the order from the Division of Dam Safeties to lower the reservoir level. Releases increased at about that time, and that convention was ignored after that point.
Thank you for the information.
I got Mr. Wallace jogged my memory. There's one more question that I don't expect you to answer, Mark, but maybe you could ask Stetson about it. And that is on page 29 of their report. There's a paragraph number one that seems to say that because the reservoir is silting in, that it's going to spill less. And that seems to, I mean, on the face of it, it seems kind of backwards to me. Maybe I don't understand it. You could ask him to explain that.
Certainly look into that.
Thank you.
If there are no more questions, thank you, Mark, for that report. Appreciate it.
I would just like to make a comment, having been very new to this. This report was really easy to understand. And I wanted to thank you because it explained a lot of things that I didn't understand before. Though it was a little redundant about the part about the fish. The steelhead, that example kept going through the whole thing. It was like some of that could have been left out. But otherwise, it was very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark. Item 6B, Water Rights for Lopez Reservoir. Approval update.
That'll be done by Mr. Ogren.
Good evening, Bob Ogren, Public Works Director. I'm actually going to also augment a little bit of Mark's discussion and some of the questions rather than, you know, jumping up during that and providing some comment. I figured these two items relate to each other. And at the last meeting, I had indicated that we would be developing a report for your committee regarding the water rights issues, the historical water rights, and what's been going on. And this is the draft so far that has been provided to me. Once we get it completed, we'll be reviewing it with the TAC first, but I still wanted to cover a couple of important points. And John, actually, I want to get back to that last slide that Mark had up, because I had indicated I had met with the State Water Board last year in 2011 to talk about water rights and the renewal. And then some of our staff, since your last meeting, also went up and talked water rights and talked about the water availability assessment also, which Mark had referred to, because they did indicate that the water availability analysis, we could avoid doing that analysis if we were to agree to some bypass flows. And the idea being is that State Water Board staff wants to issue us a new water rights permit even before the HCP is done, with the idea then that there would be a reopener once the HCP is done. And what they had indicated was that a couple of conditions, but basically we get right back into this period of time right in here. And so as Mark had indicated, that the green line itself is a reflection of the current base, what we had historically delivered in those periods of time. And what also the permit, although we didn't always comply with it, had indicated that 2 months out of the year, whatever into the reservoir was released, June, July. And those are called bypass flows. And so State Water Board's current position is that if we do bypass flows for not just June and July, but also August and September, then they would say, okay, fine, that's good enough. We don't have to do the water availability analysis and sort of give us a pass on that. Well, the thing is that bypass flows aren't indicated on this chart anywhere. But it is the next step in terms of Stetson asking us to say, okay, if we had historically released in those 4 months the amount of the water that had flowed in, then what would be our situation? In some respects, that's a good first analysis also, because in those summer months, if we released, or if we followed a bypass rule curve, then certainly that would satisfy any of the riparian rights and any other downstream users during that period of time. But we need to do that analysis. We need to do that analysis on bypass flows and then combine it with the HCP flow regime in order to say then what would that have as an effect on the storage and the overall operations. That's a next step because, again, depending on what the results of that analysis are, we may have to do more water availability analysis, or, you know, it just is going to come down to the question of can we agree to those. But we're getting that history in there. Also included in the history here are the 5 protests that were filed to our water rights permit, Fish and Game, National Marine Fisheries Services, the California Sports Fishermen's Fishing Alliance, and then the two that I guess I had, the California Sports Fishing Protection Alliance, and then the two that I had lost in my memory were Rural Water Company and Golden State Water Company, both who had filed protests, and basically concurrent with the litigation on the Santa Maria groundwater basin, because their protest leads off with, we have senior water rights. My belief is that those two have been dismissed either formally or that they were basically
dismissed as part of the litigation, but that's some of the follow-up research that we have to do on it as well. In a nutshell, you know, we're getting that historical water rights analysis together. I think the in terms of just augmenting Mark's discussion a little bit, and the idea of, you know, Mr. Gehring talking about, well, what about surplus water? And I think that the two risks that really do exist in terms of the non-environmental releases will continue to be surplus water, that to the extent that it was available for municipalities, it may not be available in the future, then that's certainly a risk of the loss of a water supply. And I think that one of the basic risks for ag is that when we plot this line about bypass flows and what would have been occurring during these 4 months under natural conditions, that to the extent that historically we had more releases to help ag out and they were above and beyond what may be bypass flows, I think that represents a risk of water loss to agriculture. And it's one of those things where the agencies know, NIMS knows, that there has to be a balancing between protecting the habitat and reestablishing habitat for species, a balance with what the human needs are. But still, it seems to me very much so that those are the two risk items, the surplus water, and then to the degree that we made releases to benefit ag above and beyond what the natural flows would have been and what they would have enjoyed in a riparian situation. Those are the two basic risks items. Now, the only other thing I'm really going to add is that about 2 or 3 weeks ago, we made our annual trip back to Washington, D.C. for a variety of purposes. And during that trip, we met with the National Marine Fisheries Service's the top person who's in charge of habitat conservation plans in the country. Now, what National Marine Fisheries does, Angela is the individual, and so we were meeting with her, and then we had Anthony Spina and one of his bosses on the phone from California. And for the most part, even though NIMS's headquarters are back east, most West Coast HCPs are really delegated to the West Coast and the East Coast. They don't, you know, they've got their other species that they have to worry about. So salmonids and steelheads and the whole group of salmons and stuff, really the expertise is on the West Coast. But the purpose in getting together was I wanted to make sure that we talked through some of the issues. We talked about where the status of where we're at on the HCP. We talked about the issue associated with agriculture and our concern regarding agriculture, the timing, the schedule, and what we're pursuing right now. And then basically, you know, left it off with the point is I wanted everybody to start making sure we knew each other's names, because if we get 18 months down the road and 24 months down the road and we started having some significant conflicts, then I wanted to make sure that, you know, they knew that we were here and to be able to increase the communications as we get down the road, because, again, if significant conflicts start to develop, then it's always smart to make sure that people in Washington, D.C. know about it, because then if locally elected officials start talking to our state and our federal representatives, then make sure that everybody's got the dialogue. I think the timing is good to making sure that everybody knows who each other is, because hopefully, you know, again, in the next couple of years, we're going to have a lot of progress. So that was the bottom line, you know, it's sort of verbal update on the water rights, the water availability and analysis itself. We may be able to avoid doing the full-blown analysis if we get in there and look at the bypass flows. But again, whether or not we can agree to 4 months of bypass flows is something we would come back and present to your committee first. It's really too speculative to see whether we could or not. But if State Water Board, again, has basically said that if we can agree to it, then we have got a quick process to getting the revised water rights permit. But we're just can't make that commitment right now without knowing how it would affect the HCP and, you know, those other variables. So at least it's a lot less intensive an analysis immediately than having to go through the whole water availability. And it does help us then focus more directly on what would be the summertime releases,
and the potentials on, you know, ag. There was one more question, too, from the prior discussion. You know, the practice of 22nd Street Bridge, yeah, that was, I think that's consistent with my understanding in terms of through the 1990s and when the HCP and the dam seismic project all started happening. The issue of groundwater pumping. So we know that in the Santa Maria Groundwater Basin litigation, Todd Engineers did an analysis that said that based on the operations of Lopez Dam, how much did Zone 3 contribute to recharge of the groundwater basin? Because underneath water rights, the idea is if you introduce a foreign water into a groundwater basin, then you have the right to be able to pump that water. And foreign water is simply non-natural water, right? I mean, so Lopez Dam, retaining water, release it in the summertime, helping with recharge of the groundwater basin, that's the foreign water. And so the idea, though, is you introduce foreign water into a groundwater basin, you have a right to pump it. That was, one, important in the groundwater litigation to show that the operations of Lopez were not reducing the amount of groundwater recharge. Because, again, in this complaint, or the complaint that was filed by Rural Water Company and Golden State Water Company, their only argument was that somehow the operations of Lopez would have reduced the natural recharge to the groundwater basin, and because they're a user of the groundwater basin, we were impairing their water rights. Well, the groundwater litigation said, well, that's not true, that in fact Todd Engineer's analysis showed that the operations of the dam helped with the recharge of the groundwater basin. Okay, but that analysis was essentially done with data under the old method of releases, the 22nd Street Bridge approach, and the much lesser releases that we did historically. Now that we're releasing more water under the interim downstream release schedule, it begs for an update of that analysis, because now that we're releasing more water, the argument is we're recharging the groundwater basin to a greater extent, and so therefore we have a greater pumping right. And I think that is the analysis then that we're talking about, because if we're going to release more water, and that causes the municipalities to pump more water, well, how do you establish the right for how much more that they can pump? And it's taking the Todd Engineers analysis that was done as part of the litigation and updating it based on whatever the new flow regime is going to be done after the HCP, and then we'll have quantifiable numbers on which to be able to address additional pumping rights that might be possible.
Questions?
Are you proposing to take Lopez water and replenish the groundwater with excess? Is that...
Well, it already does it. Ever since the dam was built, the operations of the dam replenished the groundwater basin greater than what natural conditions had been doing. And that's simply the result of storing wintertime flows, releasing them in the summertime, and, you know, taking advantage of summertime percolation. Because in the wintertime, if you're fully saturated, then you're fully saturated and it's recharging as fast as it can. And so your ability to recharge your groundwater basin more is in your drier season. So historically, the operations of the dam already provided a contribution to recharge. And the idea is that if we end up modifying the approach, it begs the question, are we recharging to a greater degree then?
Okay. Excuse my ignorance, but is that two separate sources of water? Is the groundwater different than the Lopez water?
Yeah.
And so you're saying to take those two different sources and mix them? Quite possibly cross-contamination?
No.
I mean, the reason I put it that way is because I do worry about the pharmaceuticals and not being able to control those in our water systems, in our sewer systems and everything. So when I hear of, say, somebody from Bakersfield coming over here and dumping their water, you know, to be absorbed into our groundwater, it makes me very nervous, you know. And I know things, that's just a small scale. So assure me that.
So we're not talking about anything with pharmaceuticals, and we're not talking about anything recharging reclaimed or recycled water. And the idea that
flow plan, as more water comes in from up above, and we're supposed to match that in terms of that with the 40%, you know, release.
Yeah, those attraction flows.
Right. Why do we have to do that if there's enough water available as it is and nothing is drying out? Why can't we retain the water as surplus water in the dam?
Well, okay, so then that's the idea that 40% or those attraction flows is the water that we're providing to the species to help with the health of the species. And I think Mark's next slide was the idea that, you know, the contracts and the municipal deliveries takes care of this, and then we've got ag, who we've historically taken care of, but those attraction flows are part of what do we do in order to try to promote the species. And the idea is they have a right to the water, too, well established in the courts under the public trust doctrine and various other laws that have been since passed and everything. So that 40%, those attraction flows are for the fish, and pretty much what it amounts to.
Just one more comment from me, Mr. Ogren. I know you've been peripherally aware that we had that seawater intrusion episode in late 2009, and in part you were very helpful in working with the board and getting us moving towards some emergency state water so
yeah.
that we could reduce pumping. And that didn't come to pass because of, well, various things, complicated various things. But instead we've relied on surplus water instead of that state water to reduce our pumping and combat the seawater intrusion episode. And so far as I can tell, our reaction to that episode has been reduced pumping and the water levels have come up. Everything's fine. But the way we were able to do that is we were able to rely on that surplus water. So that's a concern. So you're a good problem solver. You might think about how we would replace that water if we need to.
I think that somehow or another that state water allocation might work itself into the mix, and so certainly.
Thank you, Pablo. Item 6C, the bylaw amendments, another verbal update.
Thank you. That will be done by me, Chair Costello. John Didotti, Public Works, Zone 3 Secretary. In January, your committee authorized a working group of two committee members, Member Vardis and Member Lucy, to work with me on an update to the bylaws. And that hadn't been done since the 1980s, so it was definitely well warranted to do. And shortly thereafter, I met with the committee and did some work with them via email as well. And the first meeting was really to get an idea of what sort of changes were desired by your committee. And it was pretty clear that there was two types of changes. One were strictly administrative, which a document from the 80s obviously needed some of those. But the others were more of a contractual nature and were related to the contracts that the agencies have with the delivery of water. And the discussion was around the Nashimeno Commission and the Nashimeno bylaws and their ability to work differently under their bylaws than your advisory committee. And the reason they're able to do so is because their contracts with those cities are different than your contracts. And so any sort of change of that nature is going to require a simultaneous amendment to the contracts. And this goes into my update with Part D here, the city managers meeting, because we had that discussion with the city managers. We being the county, are open to amendments to the contracts, but that level of work on the bylaws right now can't happen until those discussions are started with the cities. So the bylaws, the administrative amendments aren't finished. There's still some outstanding language that needs to be provided and worked on. I want to loop back in with the subcommittee so we can wrap that up and hopefully have the administrative updates to your board at that time for approval. But working on those contractual changes, and by that I mean there's issues around your authority Right now the bylaws describe it as persuasion, and the Notch Minnow Commission has a little more authority than just persuasion, but then that also affects the voting rights of the agencies and the appeal process. If a decision by the Notch Minnow Commission is overturned by the Board of Supervisors, there's a different appeal process, and that's all interconnected in those in the contracts with those cities as well. So that's my update on the bylaws, and be open to take any questions or comments.
I'd like to comment on this. I did attend that meeting, and in the body writing this body's mission statement, what I would was hoping that we would have today was the suggestions that we had worked out to bring forth to the committee for consideration, not even a vote, just a discussion. And when I saw it as a verbal update, I was slightly disappointed. I thought that we would at least have the discussion around the two at-large seats that don't have terms on them, where the rest of the members do have term limits. We all have four. We're elected for 4 years. Our at-large seats do not have, they're endless. And so we had that discussion, and I thought that was very important. Also, too, is there was a few other things, but I do think that it's very important that this body does pay attention to their bylaws and their mission statement, because many people are asking what it almost appears to be a duplication, this committee, beyond briefings. You know, I attend RAC, same information. There's TAC, there's tech. You know, I'm sure there's many, many more. And so I think the model for the North County is a very good model, and I was hoping that that one would be brought and that this body could, you know, look at the two. You know, this is a bylaws. This is an advisory body. That is a commission. You know, there is a distinct difference between the two. They do hold different weights. So I'd ask that this be put back on the agenda, and that written recommendations in a draft form be brought back to the body, and that the body work on the mission statement.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, so yes, I did not attend the meeting, but thanks for Mr. Diodati and his efforts. I'm curious about the contracts to see if there's an opportunity there, with reviewing those and seeing if there could be some amendments or refinements to the contracts that the cities have.
There's definitely an opportunity, and that was discussed with the city managers at our city manager meeting, which we can launch into that discussion now or wait, I'm fine.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see what actions we could take to move that along.
Anyone object to bringing the city manager item forward now?
Yep.
Okay, that's fine.
By all means, too.
Just to wrap up item three, I have no problem. The reason the bylaws weren't at this meeting was because there were some outstanding language that wasn't ready yet, so I have no problem bringing those back to the what would that be, May meeting for discussion and possible even approval of those amendments.
I have a question. Where are the bylaws available at and the mission statement? Are they like at my city?
There possibly could be a copy there. I have some bylaws here that I can get for you. They're hand-typed, so they're not electronic, but I can scan and email you a set.
Why don't you send everyone a set?
Okay.
Because it's kind of difficult to discuss something without having seen it.
No problem.
Scanned into it.
So going back to my question and what you were going to state about the city manager's report and next steps, how that could be brought along or shepherded.
Okay, so we had our second annual city manager's meeting that was attended by public works staff and city managers and directors of special districts, and discussed most of the items that you've been discussing the last few meetings, the HCP budget, capital projects, and we concluded with a discussion on the bylaws, and that their advisory committee has been, for the last few meetings, discussing bylaws and the need for a review and possible amendments. And talked about the two types of changes, the administrative changes and then the changes that would affect the contractual, the contracts themselves. And the county's public works perspective is that we're fine with possibly making amendments to the contracts and modeling it more after the Nascimento Commission. That's a, you know, a newer take of a newer type of contract that's not as old as the ones that you guys have, and might be a model that would work down here in the South County. And your city managers were open to that, but that would be something that would need to be initiated by them. So we're, you know, if there's direction from your board to return to them and start those discussions, I'd be open to that.
I see a lot of heads bobbing, but nobody's talking. Well, I think we all need to see the existing bylaws.
Yes.
And then, secondly, if there's direct relationship between the contracts and whatever structure we might have to changing those bylaws, it has to be, you
know, construction window for operating in a creek. So that's the status of Rodriguez Bridge today.
Okay. John, let me ask you, do you have to get a permit for that over little overpass?
Yeah, there's a couple permits, and it's the main permit is the Army Corps of Engineers. It has caused a bit of a schedule of drag.
Have they issued the permit to you yet?
That I don't know. Is Mark still here? Has that been issued? Please.
I just see that a lot of times you have troubles getting your permits. I see you putting the requests in, but where you're sending them, they're not very responsive a lot of the times.
Yeah, Mark Hutchinson again. The Rodriguez requires permits from Department of Fish and Game, Army Corps of Engineers, and the Regional Water Quality Control Board, and the Army Corps is required to consult with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries Service. At this point, the Army Corps, there was a bit of a delay in them initiating consultation, about 6 months' worth, which we've worked through that. National Marine Fisheries Service has come back with a very long list of questions about the engineering for the project, and we've been able to ascertain that the Army Corps failed to send all of the pertinent information to National Marine Fisheries Service. So we're doing an end-around and sending it to them ourselves, connecting the National Marine Fisheries Service fisheries management engineers with the engineers that actually designed the project. Fish and Wildlife has asked a couple of questions about some listed species that are a little bit difficult to deal with because they're certainly not present, but we'll deal with that in the interim.
And I guess, John, the question I'd have is, you know, we've been unfortunate that we haven't had the rainfall. They were predicted to have a 1 to 2, perhaps 2 inches of rain this weekend. What's the threat level?
Of spilling? And causing that scouring that we were discussing?
Scouring.
Yeah, it's low at this point. This storm shouldn't cause any spilling.
You'd have to have, 4 or 5 inches?
Yes, exactly.
Concentrated rain.
Correct.
Don't think it's going to happen. Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, then the item 7B, the Lopez water tank access security fencing status update.
So this is a project that was budgeted for fiscal year 11-12, and then the TAC had requested that staff bring back a couple alternatives to them for consideration, and that happened at the beginning of this month, and it was concluded that those were either too costly or time-consuming, and that the perimeter fencing, as originally proposed, was the most appropriate project to proceed with. So this is phase one. It's a three-phase project. Still believe that it will come in at the proposed budget of 11-12, but the work's now going to be done in 12-13. And phase one is west side fencing around the treatment plant facility, security fencing, and is budgeted about $150,000.
And that's coming from this year's budget? So the carryover?
It was budgeted this year. It's just the work's going to be completed next year.
Does that also include the access road to the tank?
No, this is just security fencing. So that's the update. I'll be providing updates at all the meetings as the work progresses.
When will that fencing be done?
It's budgeted over 3 years. I'll talk about that in the eight-year capital outlay, but phase two and three will happen in the next few years.
Thank you. Any further questions? No, we'll move along then to item eight, action items, the eight-year capital outlay plan.
One second. Okay, so this is the eight-year capital outlay plan, and I'll walk you through the projects that are budgeted for 12-13. The first is Rodriguez Bridge. There's an additional funding request that is due to the fact that the original budget was based on about a 40% design, and we got further into design, realized that there were some additional costs, and then also the purchasing of the backup piping and having that emergency plan in place caused for the additional $165,000 expenditure. Do you want me to stop for questions or walk through them all one at a time?
Let's field the questions as we go, then. I think it's probably best. Any questions on this item? Okay, thank you. Okay.
The next project is the perimeter.
The adjacent land acquisition. Is that still being envisioned, or is that now out in lieu of building an access road at some point?
What are you looking at? I'm sorry.
I'm looking at Exhibit A.
Okay.
Second item from the bottom.
Yeah, that's being forecasted out there in 2016, and.
Right, but that would be that land purchase wouldn't be necessary if you build the access road, right?
I don't know. I can follow up and find out for you.
Okay. On to item C.
At one moment. Yeah, item C is the pigging and. That is also a phased project, and in the next fiscal year, this is going to be the design, sort of an investigation into design of the pigging project for the big line, and it's $105,000, which a portion of that will be used for the evaluation of the line, and then the rest will be set aside for the actual pigging work that will happen a couple fiscal years down the road.
Is that the red line on here, then?
Where's my map? Yes, correct.
So the red line will be 3 years' worth of work?
Yeah, it's a substantial work effort.
Item D
is valve replacement controls at the terminal reservoir, and $125,000 budget item, and anticipated work will start right away with the new fiscal year. Get that in place.
Completed in 2012-13.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay, next item.
Item E is a Department of Dam Safety requirement to get some fencing around the spillway. $10,000 budget item for that work effort.
I've been asked by my mayor, is that not something, I know it's a very small item, that needs to be shared with the county, or is that completely our responsibility?
Well, the spillway is a facility for the dam. Typically, if there's a park fence around the campground or something, that would definitely be borne by the county parks department, but this is a dam facility. As a requirement of the Division of Dam Safety, and so this is a line item that's the responsibility of the contractors.
Very good. Very good. And item F.
This is an equipment replacement, ongoing, just somewhat of a sinking fund to build up for future capital replacements of assets, and the $35,000 will help go into developing that asset replacement plan.
There's nothing specific that needs to be replaced right now. We're just anticipating that there will be needs.
Correct.
Very good. Any other questions? Okay, we'll move along then to item 9, the proposed budget.
That'll be done. The presentation will be done by Jenny Brunick.
Mr. Chairman, I had a question before we moved into that, having to do with the CIPs, if I might.
Sure.
I noticed on the write-up for the items, we talk about the funding that is allocated for the projects, and it goes into previous year funding as well as the new allocations for this year. But, John, there's nothing here that shows the cost to date, and I thought that we had asked that at one time to be shown so that maybe it was in the finance committee meeting that we had, but we have no information that shows how much we've encroached into that budget at this time. We just show what's been allocated in past years and in future years. I don't know how the committee feels about that, but it seems like it would be, from a budgeting standpoint, it'd be nice to know how far we are into that budget.
I agree with that.
And that's fine. I'm sorry if that's an oversight, but I can work with the appropriate staff member to have that in the next one.
Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Very good. Any other questions? Okay, then we'll move right along.
Good evening, Jenny Brunick, County Public Works. Tonight I will be presenting the 2012-13 budget. First, I'll start with the advisors. We'll review it and approve it. And the overview, as you can see, the estimated versus actual is kind of leveling off. I've got a five-year plan, a new one. The last one we did was in, I believe, June of 2010. So hope maybe by next week I'll mail those out to your finance people. And so the overall expenditures have decreased by 1.44%. Just a couple of highlights. There, O&M went up less than 1%, and again, that is because of the maintenance at the terminal dam relating to the tool removal and some additional mowing at the water treatment plant. Debt service went down 2.34%. That's due to the refinancing of the bonds in June 2011, which provides an annual savings of $62,000 a year. Our capital outlay is down 5.32%, and that's pretty much consistent to what we've been in the past. And let's see. Oh, and then the 12-13 billings are less than the projected five-year billing estimates that were provided to your agencies in June 2010. So, again, the updated one I'll be providing within the next week. And the recommended action today is that you approve the or endorse the 2012-13 budget. And the end. And any questions?
Let's see. Let's start with some questions.
Is this budget going to be presented to the different councils? Because the position I'm in now is, since our council has not reviewed this, I will not be able to endorse this at this time.
We come in January. As I said earlier, we present them to you. And I don't know if, I mean, you've got 2 months basically to that it's out there. We've talked to your finance people. We've met with tax. So I'm not sure what
your process is. Because I understand it's on our schedule in April.
Excuse me?
It's on our schedule for council in April.
Oh, well,
whatever reason.
Okay. I know the city of Arroyo Grande.
Then at this time, then I won't endorse it.
Okay.
Yeah, the city of Pismo Beach, we reviewed it, and the council made a motion for me to endorse this budget at this meeting.
And we've reviewed it also in Arroyo Grande.
Oceanos has reviewed it, but I have questions, too.
Okay, that's fine.
Well, go on with your questions, please.
Okay. You know, we're it seems like we're always playing catch-up at Oceano, right? Well, we now have a permanent general manager. Mm-hmm. Tom Gieselin was hired last night as a permanent general manager. So we won't have any huge learning curves or old audits that have been lost in the shuffle, per se. But we're somewhat perplexed about our debt, and that we were led to believe that we were not eligible for the refi on the bond. And we've gotten several mixed messages from bond agents, and so I have to go back to you as I can't find the interest rate that the county is charging Oceano for the $44,802.
Okay. I'm going to give it my best shot, and then I'm going to bring in my life.
Yeah, because the interest rate that we came up with, and I know that Tom has called you numerous
times. Right, Tom and I have spoke.
Tom and I have met, you know, and we both really applaud you on how you lay out your budgets. I've read many, many budgets, and you really do a very good job, and it's very comprehensible. But I can't find the interest rate without doing a total calculation of the bond before. So if you could just point me to the right column.
Actually, that didn't change at all. It's what
it's
been in the
4.59
past. 4.59 or? I don't think that I have that with me. I have the new numbers with me, but I don't believe I have that one. Let me double check. If not, I'm going to have to.
Because I'm looking at it from a fair market value. You know, I'm looking from it that if we're paying 4.59 on $44,000, right, to our, you know, county, which makes you the lender, you know, it seems a little high to me. I mean,
you know what? I'm gonna have to.
I'm so ever so gently walking here.
No, that's fine. I'll let.
You know, even though Jenny doesn't have the interest rate to quote tonight, I wouldn't expect her to have it either. But certainly Jenny and Will will be able to confirm with Mr. Gieselin what the applicable rate is. And so it's a whole higher level, and people evaluate that. And so when Oceano wasn't complying with its continuing disclosure requirements, it wasn't submitting the audit statements, it wasn't showing that it had the coverage that it needed to have under its rates and charges obligations, Oceano became ineligible to participate in the bond refinancing. And so because the principal value of Oceano's share of the debt was small enough that the flood control zone 3 reserves essentially paid off the old debt on behalf of Oceano, and then Oceano's obligation to zone 3 is just the same interest rate that it had previously been paying under the old bonds. That's how the new bond interest rate was established. And the idea being is that Oceano wasn't eligible to participate in the refinancing and take advantage of the lower interest rate because the fair market value out there and those who did the lending just simply said that they're not eligible. They're not complying with the continuing disclosure requirements. It's akin to getting a really bad credit report. And if anything, the idea would be that if we had pushed for it, then the municipal markets would have said, well, Oceano has to pay a higher interest rate. And so being able to maintain that old interest rate from the prior bonds, even though the covenants weren't being complied with, was where Oceano actually kind of got a good deal from a fair market value standpoint. Now, with that said, one of the things that I think Oceano has every right to do is whether it's participating through the Special Districts Association and the ability to issue bonds. But Oceano can always, at any time, if there's an interest rate and a lending that you have, you can always borrow money from the municipal markets now that you're getting the audits done and you've got your financial situation back on the right track. You can always go out there, try to take advantage of existing interest rates that are lower, issue the bonds, and then pay off the debt that is owed to Zone 3. So, you know, the idea is that the municipal bond market
in evaluating the status and the lack of compliance at the time, they really do set the rules on the fair market value transactions. But now that you've got your, you know, you turned the corner on that situation, then, you know, certainly the opportunity exists for Oceana to go out and try to work with the Special Districts Association to refund that debt.
And the organization has talked about refining this because it's such a small amount. And I think at this point we have to agree to disagree, because I've spoke to several bond agents and they said that we didn't need to even be in it because we're less than a third. So we weren't even part of the initial entity, but I understand
what
you said.
My point, though, is that, look, the people who are working on the bond transaction when the refinancing happened are the individuals. They're the ones who did the underwriting. They're the ones who helped set the interest rate. And we can always go to other people after the fact and say, oh, well, what do you think? But they weren't part of the transaction. They were not part of establishing the arm's length transaction and the fair market value evaluation at that time.
So, and Tom had worked, did he speak to you about the pigging? And okay, great. So that's all worked out, correct? Thank you so much on that. And there was one other thing, too. That was about it.
Thanks. Was that it?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. Thank you.
I mean, I can check with the interest rate. I'll email it to you tomorrow.
You don't have to jump at it. I mean, you know.
Okay.
I'll catch up with you.
Okay, sounds good. And oh, I'm sorry.
Any other questions? Entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move to endorse the proposed 2012-2013 budget for the Zone 3 Advisory Board.
Second. Go ahead.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Seeing none, we'll go to a vote, please.
Member Molnar.
Abstain.
Member Gehring.
Yes.
Member Vardis.
Yes.
Member Lucy.
Yes.
Member Wallace.
Yes.
Member Ikeda.
Yes.
And Chairman Costello.
Yes. Passes. Thank you.
Just one thing I'd like to add. I have some budget books available for your council if you would like me to, maybe like three right now, if you want to take them back. They're available on our website. So whatever I can do to make it convenient and easy for you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Item 10, future agenda items. Anyone have anything they want to be brought to the table?
Where'd we end up with the Anthony Spina? I don't remember.
I had the same comment, Mr. Chairman. I didn't know when. I guess Mr. Diodati will come back, or Mr. Hutchinson, with some follow-up as to when Mr. Spina might be available to come back and chat with us.
When it would be a profitable time for us.
Yeah. At the proper time, if he's got something to contribute.
Did we not agree to pay for his trips up here? Was that
traveling per diem?
Yes, we. And the last time he came up, I remember the gentleman saying, "I don't know a lot." So I have to agree with you. I know it's a beautiful drive for him and everything, you know, but.
Very good. We'll see that maybe bringing forward. Any other future agenda items? Well, then we'll go down the table for committee member comments. Anything?
No, Chairman?
No, just like I stated before, Tom Gieselin is the general manager for Oceana, and we're all very, very, very happy to have him on board.
Thank you.
I'd just like to let the committee know, as well as the viewing public out there, that the South County Sanitation District will be embarking to hold a